Now, with the virtue of trust, trust in the spiritual nights. In the night of the senses, God deprives the soul utterly of every conscious spiritual joy. It is his wish also to deprive the soul of its humanly inspired activities. The soul whose knowledge and whose love are of this kind may not achieve union with God in his infinite simplicity. With this motive, God simplifies the soul, slaying its natural activity, and gradually replacing it by an ever-increasing passivity. Where once it used human means to know God and to pray to him by meditation and the aid of conscious ideas, it must make its own a supernatural approach to knowledge. It must know God by the infused light of contemplation. It no longer knows God, as do other men, by making distinction between the ideas of the senses and those of revelation, but by a secret light mysteriously received that falls directly upon the soul with no intervention of the senses. Where before its love was active, it must love with a passive and infused love that is the free gift of divine generosity. Its powers must therefore be stripped of their customary method of functioning, and in its place, a superhuman and divine mode must be substituted, that they may be transformed and impregnated with God. In brief, God prepares the soul for the divine life of perfect union by progressively replacing the soul's own inherent activity with his infused and divine activity, its human life with his divine life. This is the reason why in the night of the senses, prayer becomes arid and sterile. The soul can no longer meditate or reason, or at best can do so with difficulty and reluctance. Its prayers become vain and empty. From the intelligence and the will, God takes the natural objective drawn from things of the senses, sparingly and gradually substituting for them a few first faint lights of infused contemplation. The wretched soul, which moreover has no realization of these changes, has no succor therefore either from the senses or from its yet undeveloped contemplation. Torpor and weariness, springing from inherent weakness, make all its prayers dull and dead. For the rest, the soul, accustomed only to the palpable things of the senses, at the beginning, holds of little worth these first supernatural and elementary glimmerings of light, of which, for the most part, it is unconscious. Unfamiliar with this new form of love and of knowledge, it grows perturbed and exasperated. It thinks itself apathetic and would, as we've said previously, return to its former methods. Later, in the night of the spirit, contemplation itself with a different end in view becomes a means of secret suffering. Blindingly it reveals to the soul the sorrowful contrast of the infinite perfections of God with its wretched self. The soul, obsessed by its own extreme abjection, turns in revulsion from itself, and becoming wholly detached from that self, is altogether absorbed into God. The essential is trust. Let nothing discourage the soul. It shall be no endeavor of ours to seek to comfort a soul given over to the night of the senses, and still less to seek to deliver it from its sufferings. A footnote. There is no need to note here that it is not for the soul itself to discern if it be in the night of the senses or in that of the spirit. Upon this, it should consult its director. Consequently, only those who through their directors know themselves to be in one of these two nights should make personal application of the thoughts contained in this chapter. To continue, patiently the divine artist cuts his diamond till its facets grow resplendent. Just so, no one can deliver the soul from its salutary sufferings under the action of God. Yet, what we would say to these souls who are infinitely worthy of immolation and of comparison alike is, have trust, now and forever, have utter trust. On this occasion, as on all others, none has been, none ever will be, deceived by trust. In the depths of the soul thus wrought upon by God, there is a secret instinct that, despite all appearances to the contrary, cries to it, "Have trust, all is well." The finger of God is here. It is He who fashions you to His own liking. Be glad of heart. This is a necessary ordeal that shall lead you towards union. Therefore, O soul beloved of God, believe in this secret and profound instinct. All is indeed well. Yet do not desire to see with the eyes of the sense. Do not seek conviction by exhaustive use of the reason. Go forward in naked faith. Go forward with trust. Though you cannot perceive it, all is indeed well. Convince yourself only of this. Because it is night, you cannot see it now. When day returns, then shall you see and understand. Then shall you bless your obdurate trust. What are we to think of this ordeal? If it be prolonged indefinitely, is this not possibly a sign that it is no ordeal but a punishment? Or rather, if it were an ordeal and a God-given grace at the outset, have I not taken the wrong turning since? Have I not spoilt all by my lack of generosity and by my inamiability? Have I not lost altogether those graces of election which God once gave me? At times, spiritual directors themselves are troubled by the long duration of the ordeal. It may last even for years. No inconsiderable period of a lifetime to be passed in a kind of inactivity and of spiritual languor. Can this be right? This is the wrong approach. The wrong approach. The length of the ordeal must not disconcert us. Both the night of the senses and the night of the spirit, according to St. John of the Cross, as is shown by the case of so many saints, last years, sometimes many years. A footnote. St. Teresa passed 18 years in purifying ordeals. St. Madeleine de Pazzi, 5 years in the first place and 16 years in the second. Blessed Henry Suso, 10 years. Blessed Angela of Foligno, 2 years in the night of the Spirit. With certain of these, the ordeals were continuous. With others, they were intermittent. To continue, nor must we believe this to be precious time lost for all eternity. God looks upon it with very different eyes. He sees the change which is wrought beneath the action of this passive purification, there in those depths of our soul of which we have so little knowledge. He sees it and is glad of heart. Truly, such time is not lost. On the contrary, it is extremely rich in results and in hidden acts of ever purer divine love. For every second of this time, many though they be, is made use of by God to work upon our soul and to prepare it for ultimate union. Nor distraction, nor inactivity in prayer. The distractions, so frequent in the prayer of souls plunged into spiritual night, are often the cause of much suffering. Yet they should not make us afraid. They are altogether natural. In contemplation, when our will alone is united to God, and the union has little or no power over our memory, our imagination, and our understanding, it is then that with the will stable in its loving unity with God, the understanding goes roaming. St. Francis de Sales and St. Teresa have described this travail of mystical souls very vividly. The great saint of prayer herself knew great suffering at its hands. During many years she could not pray a prayer as long as the Paternoster without distractions. She has left us this prescription, not to rid us of distractions, for no such prescription exists, that we may not know spiritual hurt on account of them. This is it. Let us never be disturbed by the noise which the rattle of our imagination makes. We are to ignore these distractions, we are to put them gently on one side. They are the tormenting flies which one brushes away, and which it were foolishness to pursue. In the depths of our soul, God has sight of our will that is stable in loving union with Him. This is His sole concern. When His good pleasure shall dictate, with a rich inpouring of His infused light equally, He is able to charm and captivate those other faculties of ours, understanding and memory, and to bring them into union with Himself. In any case, some may well say, our pitiful prayers are because of their pitifulness unavailing. We no longer know how to concentrate upon supernatural truth. While prayer merely repels us, in that it has become an empty and inoperative thing, strangely contrasting with our ardent meditation of days gone by. This, too, should neither astonish nor frighten us. It is, as we've previously seen, the natural result of the divine action. God has altered our approach to prayer. Step by step, He changes our activity into prayer, that an ever-increasing part may be played by infused knowledge of God and by simple contemplation. A footnote. In reality, God does not lessen the activity of the intelligence, but takes from it its human and natural approach to knowledge, and by the gifts of wisdom and of understanding, grants it a superhuman approach that is infinitely more exalted and that surpasses every concept and every image. The activity of the intelligence is not diminished. It is transformed and impregnated with God. The soul has no direct consciousness of this superhuman mode of activity, but merely an oblique consciousness begotten of the darkness and the suffering of these nights, that is to say, by the cessation of the human use of intelligence. To continue, let us then be comforted. These hours of prayer that seem so empty are in reality brimming with acts of divine love that are direct and not reflex. Though we do not suspect it, we love uninterruptedly. Each hour of prayer brings to blossom in the garden of our heart countless flowers that, though they be invisible to our own eyes, are not less delightful in the eyes of God. Nor inactivity in the spiritual life. The inactivity in question, some again may say, permeates my whole life. It affects everything. It is even difficult, I find, to make those short exclamatory prayers and those aspirations that in former days I loved so much. I feel a great need of opportunities for humility, for patience, for mortification, of which I no longer have perception even. In certain directions, my efforts seem wholly barren, doomed in advance to failure. I would correct this or the other fault, yet never succeed in the attempt. To all these anxieties of yours, there is but the one answer. So only you do your utmost. Have no fear. Do what you can. Obey God's prompting, nor have any anxiety as to the result, which in the soul's night you shall be unable to foresee. No less than your prayer, all your days shall be filled with direct acts of love, with heroic patience, with utter self-surrender. From your heart they shall emanate, wave after wave, to become the refreshing delight of your beloved. Again, if in certain directions your efforts have nothing to show for them, this is because God is working in you to other ends. For most emphatically, God's efforts are neither fruitless nor vain. Though you be unaware of it, He gives you a strong conviction of your own nothingness. He fills you with aversion for the unprofitable and egoistical self. Though you're unconscious of it, He destroys your offensive self-complacency. Your own activity may be far from encouraging. His divine activity, secret though it be, is magnificent indeed. The best activity possible to you is passivity under the divine action. It is for this that God is chiefly solicitous. It is His express desire to lessen your own natural activity and to transform it into a passivity that shall be marvelously amenable to grace. He makes you die to the self, that in you he may live and perform his work. O dear and desirable death, that for all its agony leads on to a life divine. Further, when desolation is at its height, when the frail bark of your soul is the plaything of the storm, cling to your knowledge that God asks no more of you than loving self-abandonment. As it is the sole activity of which you are capable, so it is all that he desires of you. Do not perturb yourself unnecessarily, mistaking this for fervor. At such times, God's requirement of you is wholly simple. Be conscious of your own nothingness. Be grateful for his mode of dealing with you. Dispose yourself for peaceful sleep, despite the angry waves. He is in the bark with you. How can you perish? Its pangs are the pangs of love, comforting characteristics of these nights. Another source of profound grief to the soul is its inevitable sense of retrogression. Failing to understand either its own state or God's action upon it, it cannot avoid the fear which it has at perception of the changes taking place in it. Its former somewhat feverish and restless activity in works and in prayer alike has been superseded by an activity that is at once simple and hidden, that savors indeed of idleness. The ecstasies of conscious love have yielded to spiritual coldness. Its desire for mortification has weakened. In its eyes, these are so many signs of spiritual torpor. Should its director seek to reassure it, "May this not be," the soul asks itself, because he has not understood as a result of its own faulty explanations. Or again, has he not given it comfort out of pure compassion, despite his own secret conviction? O hapless soul, it is the night of your spirit. Remember that. Be convinced of that. Spiritually, you are like a blind man. You yourself cannot see, yet your director sees for you. It is not torpor. Love is far from dead in you. Your sadness and your grief are but the birth pangs of your love. The very reason of your sadness and your disquiet is that, without suspecting it, you love with such intensity. How clear and simple is this reflection! How well calculated to reassure you! Cling to your belief in it. Not once, but many times you've told yourself, "So only I can be sure of pleasing Jesus, all the sufferings of this night are of no account." The dread, the anxiety, at times the certainty even of displeasing God, it is the thought of these which tortures me. Would you have used such language to yourself had you not loved, did you not still love, Jesus passionately, although unaware of it? Your love has gone from you, your conscious love. Yes, this is true. Yet of your hidden love, Jesus is well aware. He perceives it with growing happiness. Your love has gone from you, the love which brought you delight, which brought you joy. Yes, this is true. Yet you have a love as good, if not better, a sorrowful love, an ardent though hidden love, a love that fills you with sorrowful aspiration towards your beloved. For as there is the joy born of love, so there is the suffering born of love. Of the latter you have now to drink deep. As in days gone by, love brought you joy, so now it brings you suffering. This last lot is surely the better far, the more to be preferred of a heart that, loving itself no longer, loves Jesus purely. And further, though you suspect it not, God is slowly instilling into you a vast love of esteem. He is giving you perception of your own repulsiveness, and so also, in a way as secret as it is mysterious, of his divine lovableness. Soon the dawn will break. Then shall this love of esteem awake you to raptures that now you cannot suspect. A footnote. It is this secret love of esteem that causes the soul, which is plunged in the night of the Spirit at any cost to prefer the will of Jesus to any of its own personal desires. Can this be torpor? To continue, there is none who is able to bring you perfect solace. One thought, however, there is that, if God will, can give you great courage and can buoy up your trust till light return. You are convinced, or all but convinced, that instead of advancing you are going backwards in the love of God and in the way of perfection. For this you reproach yourself. Yet for this has Jesus ever reproached you? Have you clear perception of any well-defined voluntary fault, of any notable infidelity? Doubtless the answer is no. You see your own unworthiness. Vaguely, you perceive your repulsiveness, your apathy, and your innumerable, more or less involuntary imperfections. Yet, of any real or grave fault, you are unable to make discovery. You surely cannot think that Jesus would allow you to go astray for anything falling short of serious infidelity. He who so greatly desires your love and your holiness, shall he abandon you to mediocrity on account of faults due to weakness or to inadvertence that he must expect on your part? Were you to lapse into a serious fault, would you not reproach yourself for this very vigorously and very wholeheartedly? Would he then leave you without a word, without a goodbye said, and so deprive you forever of his supreme graces? Jesus has made you no bitter reproaches. Far from it. It is true that when lulls come in the storm, he does not return to give you the comforting sense of his presence. Yet, nevertheless, you are aware that he's not far off. You surmise it. Now surely it is to peace, to surrender to himself, that he invites you instead of to the severe reprimand of your expectation. In these hours of glimmering light, when the night grows less black and faint gleams flicker through the darkness, cling to your belief. Hold fast to your salutary yearnings for trust, for these are the voice of Jesus, which whispers murmuringly, "It is I, be not afraid." Take note of this. It is often characteristic of the night of the senses, and far more especially so of the night of the spirit. The soul has a vivid perception of its misery and its unworthiness, but it has no clear conviction of any outstanding fault deliberately committed, or of any serious lack of generosity that would justify its loss of divine graces. Consequently, Jesus does not cast any serious reproach upon it, or give it the conviction that for this fault or the other it has incurred his displeasure. Just as it has a general sense of its own unworthiness, though it can recall no grave failing, so in the night of the soul, above all, it has a clear impression that in some obscure manner it has displeased God. These suggestive words of St. Augustine have particular application at this juncture. O God, you pursue those who flee from you, and you flee from those who pursue you. This is precisely the experience of the soul. It has given God cause for discontent. Upon the soul he turns his back. It no longer pleases him. Its repulsiveness alone accounts for his displeasure. God no longer loves it, and it no longer loves God. This impression follows upon the changes which we've already noted in the soul: the loss of conscious love, its own apparent inactivity, the frightening spectacle of its repulsiveness. How poor and pitiable beggar that it is, can it draw near to the great King? Can it speak to him of love, still less of that divine union of which it fondly dreams? Moreover, in the night of the Spirit, God himself, by his divine action upon the soul, still more intensifies this fear, this anxiety of love. Deliberately, he makes it believe that it has given him displeasure. To stimulate its love, he hides himself, sure that the soul will make response with ardent aspirations, with violent love pangs, with despairing appeals that without its knowledge give great pleasure to God. A comparison from St. John of the Cross. Let hours of consolation be remembered. Hitherto we have scarcely touched upon those other ordeals that during these nights God often sends that he may intensify his work of purification. When the soul is in the grip of desolation, half distracted and given over to anxiety, God sends contradictions, persecutions, infidelities on the part of its friends, humiliations at the hands of its superiors, or often sickness that stretches it upon a bed of pain. Almost invariably, too, strong temptations assail it from time to time. It is obvious, therefore, how greatly the soul, which passes through the crucible of such tribulations, needs to encourage itself and to incite itself to trust. How greatly it stands in need of its director's stimulating advice. Let it then remind itself of the purpose of these sufferings. Let it think of that union with God of which it is so desirous, and which upon a day yet to come shall be its victor's crown after similar struggles. The noble conception which it has of God, its beloved, must surely bring it to love all which rids it of its blemishes and of its imperfections, and so prepares it for ultimate union. None is written more graphically than St. John of the Cross, of the night of the senses and of the spirit. In his famous Dark Night, this great mystical teacher has a fine comparison that he develops at length, recollection of which will help us to endure these purifying sufferings and to increase our love for them, since their purpose is to remove every stumbling block from that union with God so greatly desired by our soul. In the night of the senses, as in that of the spirit, the fire, both of divine love and of infused contemplation, St. John says, works upon the soul to transform it into God, even as the more material fire works upon the wood which it seeks to transform into flame. It begins by drying it and ejecting its sap from it. Subsequently, it blackens it, leaves it shapeless, charred, and evil-smelling. In this way, it extracts and renders palpable all those crude and hidden constituents which impeded the fire's action. Lastly, it sets it on fire and quickly converts it into such shining light and warmth that the wood seems to be transformed into fire itself. Just so the fire of loving contemplation, before it affects the soul's transformation and union with itself, rids it of all its impurities. It purges all evil inclinations from it, blackens its vanity, and chars its egoism, till soon it seems much more repulsive and much more imperfect than it was before. The wretched soul with tears laments its unhappy lot. It ought, on the contrary, to be full of rejoicing at the thought that this same seemingly cruel fire of obscure and loving contemplation makes it suffer only on account of its own impurities and imperfections. When once it's been sufficiently purified, this same fire of contemplation kindles it anew in so sweet and delightful a fashion that it forgets all its past travail and surpassingly rejoices at these salutary sufferings which by slow degrees have transformed it into a living flame of divine love. Then, too, the recollection of graces received in former days, do we but know how to make good use of it, can be a precious solace to us. We shall then remember those delightful days in which God, Jesus, and Mary surpassingly bestowed upon us every kind of tenderness, heaping us with loving caresses. It was then, in this world's night, that precious flashes of insight unveiled for us the mysterious realities of the world beyond. God and Our Lady desired here upon this earth to give us a glimpse of this great love that they have for us. The glimpsed glory fled, night in its blackness closed round us once more. While invisible though they had become, all things revealed by those flashes of insight continued yet to be. For they are the faithful reflection of the love of God and of Mary alike. Glimpsed for a moment of time by the eyes of our soul, the fact of them remains, though we neither perceive it nor are conscious of it. Now and forever they love us with the same tenderness, with that unutterable tenderness which brought us rapture when first we were aware of it. It is good indeed to reflect upon this and the grace implicit in it. For these flashes of insight have made us understand, to a certain extent experimentally, those great truths that lie beyond the senses. What consolation and what a source of trust it is to reflect that even in our night, when all things appear changed, all things, in fact, continue to be as they were before. Moreover, this is true of our own love that we have for God. Temporarily, we believe that we love God no longer. Formerly, when flashes of divine revelation illumined our soul, love kindled our heart to flame. By this means, God gave us greater understanding and more vivid realization of those supernatural and suprasensible virtues that are the true life of our soul. These flashes have fled to be followed by darkness. Yet this tender love for Jesus and all these supernatural virtues continue to exist, to thrill through our being in secret and suprasensible fashion. This thought is indeed well calculated to fill our hearts with joy and with trusting tenderness for God. Jesus, who in us relives his passion, the soul's recollection of the long night of the senses, from which it has happily issued in the past and from which it has derived so many benefits, can be of considerable help to it when it is plunged into the terrible night of the Spirit. For there is a marked parallel between these two nights. Do you then reflect from time to time, O hapless soul, upon that initial ordeal? For just as now, so then, you were afraid. You were in utter doubt. Yet an unassailable trust was your stay, until light came and the darkness fled. Remember then those graces that came with the new day. Remember the dear presence of Jesus restored to you. Remember his tenderness grown even greater than before. The new ordeal is as the old, but more torturing than the old. It is essential that all things die in you, that God may perfectly live in you. As of old, so now the dawn shall break, for God will have completed his work. Trust then in him. So far he has led you, he will not forsake you now that you draw near to perfection of holiness. Later, in the night of the Spirit, remember that long ago in self-surrender you became the plaything of Jesus. You made surrender to him of all your being, that he might live in you in the stead of your repulsive self. You renounced life's joy, that in you and through you he might rejoice according to the dictates of his good pleasure. Surely, then, you need not be amazed at the extent of your suffering. For has not this Jesus, who lives in you, and with whom you strive to identify yourself, a great hunger for suffering? And is it not his aim, by suffering in you and through you, to sate his hunger? There's no doubt of it. The desire of Jesus is to suffer in you and through you. As the great apostle declared, "You shall fill up in yourself that which was lacking in the passion of Christ." It is his will in you to live again his dolorous passion. By this ordeal of your soul's night, he does indeed effect this. In you and through you, he relives his bitter anguish of Gethsemane. He relives the travail and the agony of his love. In you once again, when the last hour comes and the darkness descends, he cries aloud, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Be of good courage. Do not falter in your obdurate trust. Like Jesus, in the last agony you shall die upon the cross, yet in you Jesus shall come to resurrection. Dawn shall break in glory. Christ shall revive in you the unutterable joy and delight of his glorified humanity. He shall fill you, while still upon this earth, with the ecstatic raptures of his divinity. Chapter 17. Trust in Temptation. The various kinds of temptation, temptations directed against purity, these above all call for great trust. Temptations are to be counted among the most sorrowful and most torturing trials that beset every generous soul in this life. To the loving soul, these trials bring pain indeed, making it doubt its very love. They seem to bring evil very near to it. They seem to make its fear increase with its increasing horror of them. There are times when it might be said that evil brushes the soul with its sinister wings. Moreover, these temptations are infinitely varied. They include temptations against the theological virtue of faith, induced by the devil, or merely suggested by the materialistic atmosphere which surrounds us. Temptations, too, against the theological virtue of hope. Temptations of spiritual weariness and of discouragement. In the interior life, we used to be so fervent. In the way of the commandments and of the counsels of God, we walked so joyously that we thought to attain to holiness in a short time indeed. Yet, if we glanced backwards over the long years of our life, we seem to have covered little ground. Plainly, holiness is not for us. We shall never attain, it would seem, to that ideal of our cherished dreams. There are temptations against the theological virtue of charity. Those temptations of various kinds that strive to win our heart, to detach it from God and to attach it to material and ephemeral things. Again, there are the many temptations directed against the moral virtues. Among these, there is one in a class apart which needs to be discussed at length. For alas, whether saints or sinners, we are all exposed to its assaults. This is the temptations against purity. Few indeed are the souls so far privileged that, like Teresa of the Child Jesus, they have never known the revolt of the flesh. From time to time, many generous souls are summoned to pass through the crucible of this ordeal, while God, who disposes of all things according to the dictates of his inscrutable wisdom, allows even these souls, who are destined to the highest holiness, to flinch beneath the fierce assaults of these temptations. The infinite variety of these temptations makes them as insidious as they are painful. Often they assume such insinuating and beguiling shapes, they so skillfully bewitch our imagination and our senses, that resistance to their seductive delight seems impossible. Equally, there are times when they attack us directly. This attack is made so fiercely and so impetuously that we are forsaken, it seems, by God, and abandoned to our human weakness. We are about to lay down our arms when the unhoped-for reinforcement of a powerful grace carries us on to final victory. Let us continue with the virtue of trust on side B.